Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to B-Ball Breakdown and the B-Ball Breakdown podcast. I'm pleased to have Amin El Hassan from ESPN to join us and talk basketball. So, Amin, thanks for coming on the show, early morning podcast here with us. What is your what's your basketball mind thinking about these days?
Well, right now I'm really thinking about the Golden State Warriors, how well they played here early on. This is the best start through, I believe, 41 games since the 96 Bulls. So, I mean, I don't think enough people are talking about how incredible that is, regardless of whether you think they're going to win a championship or not. That's incredibly difficult to do, particularly for a first-year coach who's never coached before. So that's the main thing I think I'm thinking about right now.
You know, it's funny. I was just talking about this last night with a friend, a coaching friend, and I told him I wish that I was, you know, 21 right now, like a young, impressionable coach looking for, inspiration, because I think I'd always sort of envisioned the notion of three-point shooting and spacing and ball movement, but I don't think I would have had the balls to do that, 15 years ago or 20 years ago when I started. I'm a triangle offense coach, and there's a sort of a certain look for that. But that's really, what's hopefully inspiring is that you can run team basketball. They do a lot of triangle stuff, but they space that floor so well and get threes and rain them down. It's like I don't think we've ever really had a team that goes on these runs every single game.
Right. You know what's funny, Coach Nick? Coach Gentry, Alvin Gentry, talked about that a lot. He said he went through his whole professional and adult life thinking about basketball one way. And then he said he came to Phoenix as an assistant coach under Mike D'Antoni, and he said within 30 games or whatever, he realized, like, everything that I've known about basketball, I can throw that out the window. And that's the idea of the modern coach. It's the flexibility to cobblestone together things that you appreciate in other people's playbooks. The idea that I should be so rigid to one certain way of playing. I think that's archaic. That's the idea. So when people say, "Oh, the triangles, it's not a modern enough offense," say, no, it's not that. It's just how do you repurpose it to fulfill basically the best out of the kind of talent that you have. And I think that's what Golden State has done, is that they've taken elements of the triangle, maybe not the full kind of Phil Jackson. Light incense and have guys visualize things and stuff, but you can definitely see it, especially when they throw the ball into the post to Bogut and they go into the split cuts and those things. So that's the thing. I think, like you said, the 21-year-old impressionable young coach right now is watching Golden State, is watching Atlanta, and saying, I don't have to say I'm running flex and that's all I'm running. I can take some flex. I can take some quick hitters from, or some 7 seconds or less type things. I can take some triangle, and I can put together a playbook that fits my personnel and fits and gets the job done.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the key here is that, this notion of read and react, is a way that you should play basketball that way. You shouldn't be staring at the sideline looking for a call on every play.
I will say this. I hate to cut you off. I will say this. People got to understand, what you're watching is literally the highest level of basketball. And within the highest level, when you talk about the Warriors and the Hawks, you're talking about a group of players who are very high IQ. Not one or two, but across the board. So if I'm a high school coach or a middle school coach, just because the play, the X's and O's look really nice and well executed, you got to understand your personnel. And that's why I always go back to, people ask me, like, what should young players be working on? And I say, everything should be skill and recognition. Because if you're skilled and you have good IQ, you can run any offense. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You'll figure it out. But I hate seeing people coaching 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds, and they're running a bunch of plays, like you said, calling signals from the sideline and all. Because now the kid doesn't have the recognition to figure out different situations, to read and react. Now, I'm not saying you should just run out there and run pickup ball either, but there should be a bigger emphasis on skill and recognition.
I mean, I agree. I mean, certainly, at the high school level, that is certainly a good opportunity to be able to teach team fundamentals and selflessness and how to exist five fingers on a hand. So for sure, but before that, yeah, it's hard to run that kind of stuff if you have players that don't have the individual skills to handle the ball and to dribble and to shoot. I fully recognize that as well. I mean, I think there are certain fundamentals that even like when I was growing up and when you were growing up, what's interesting is what's been lost. Like when I was playing in sixth grade, if somebody threw the ball to the high post, you cut to the basket.
Right.
And no one ever told me that. It was just sort of what you did. And maybe it was, I don't know how it was passed down. And at some point, even those kind of things disappeared. Those basic notions of movement disappeared. And that's what's kind of concerns me a little bit because, you know, it's so interesting when you watch players now and their instincts and what they instinctually do on the that seems to be so backwards from, you know, a different era.
Right. It's funny. It's another example that whenever I'm watching college basketball, and I love when people say, oh, I love college basketball because they actually play defense. And I say, what do you mean, overplay everything? I say, Coach Nick, if I'm overplaying you, I'm defending you, I'm overplaying you, what do you do?
Backdoor.
Exactly. It's like, I don't understand why no one does it in college. Just backdoor cut. And that's the end of that. You do that a couple of times, and that'll get them conservative again. So, it's like you said, there's little things that I don't know if anyone ever told me that. But you, from playing and from being around the game, you figure these things out. If someone's front in the post, if someone's front of my teammate in the post, and I'm off ball, what do I do?
If
I'm on offense and my teammate is being fronted in the post, he's trying to post up. Do I do?
A quick pass to the top, and then you pass it over the top. Yeah,
over the top. It's just someone flash high post, and then we'll go high low. So these are all things that are just really simple. But I think somewhere along the lines in basketball development in this country, I think the emphasis on skill has gone up. I don't know, maybe you might disagree, but I feel like guys are working more and more at a younger age, getting in the gym and shooting and working on that. But recognition isn't there. These little things, figuring out, oh, if this happens, then I automatically do this. And it's not even a question. And that's where the difference is now. And we're getting players who come to the league who may be skilled, but they're just not good enough because they don't know how to play.
You know, one of the first questions I ask a coach if I meet somebody new and we're talking is, are you a part method or a whole method coach? And I would say 15% stare at me blankly. And then a greater percentage will say whole. And I think that is a big issue because, for instance, on that play you just described, when you want to be able to drill, he's getting fronted in the post, so you pass the ball to the top of the key, and then you hit him there. That's a simple two-line drill with the with a guy who's an all-time post, right, with a defender. And you run it. It's a two-line drill, and so you're used to passing the top, and you're used to catching it and feeding the post. You do that for 5 minutes, you're going to get a bunch of reps. You do that for, you know, 4 weeks every day, and all of a sudden you have that read and react without having to have, you know, relied on any kind of high IQ per se. It's almost muscle memory and rhythm, and I feel like that is what we've also been missing. And no matter what, I used to get into arguments with Tex Winter about the triangle offense and how you teach it because he would go whole, part, whole. And I was always like, you know, I just do it part. I do two-line drills, three-line drills, four-line drills. I don't even get to the whole thing for weeks, because I always felt like it was just more of an intrinsic understanding, and it might take longer, but I thought it was always a stronger connection once they got it.
All right, method shooting was always a big part for us in Phoenix. And again, it's all about like isolating those situations. And that's easier for the offense that we ran because for the wings, at least, most of the time, they were doing either one of three things. Either they're filling in the corners or going through a flex cut. Or in some cases, when we have good post-up wings like Jason Richardson and Grant Hill, you got a post-up. Usually off that flex cut, you just stop right there and that we dump it in. So, you know, basically what I'm saying is for a lot of the players, it wasn't that much decision making to do, and so it was easier to go to method shooting with them as opposed to Steve Nash, who had literally a universe worth of options he could do. But again, you didn't need to drill him because he knew what, you know, that's just Steve. He was just gifted on his own.
Well, you know, take us back to Phoenix, because I'm not sure if everybody knows your background. You were tell us, when did you start working for the Suns and what did you do?
I started in 06. I was an intern. I worked in the scouting department mainly. I helped the coaching staff in 06. This is the 06-07 season. And then at the end of that season, I became the video coordinator, and I worked almost exclusively with the coaching staff. And then after that, I went back to the front office, and I was a scouting coordinator and then assistant director of basketball ops. And then I ended up being a scout right before I left.
Wow. So were you, as a video coordinator, were you on the court at all with the team?
Yeah. So practice, mainly, you know, practice, because the head video coordinator was kind of like a quasi-assistant coach. He's actually an assistant coach at the Nuggets now, Coach Gillespie. But so he was way more involved on the court. I was as the runt of the litter. You know, I'd make sure the scoreboard was on, run the shot clock, and get in arguments with players about whether I got the right score on the board and things like that. And then after practice, I would help with player development, usually with the bigs, with Mark West and John Shumate. We work with Robin Lopez and work with couple of the other young bigs on the roster. I would never like to puff up what I did on the court. I was literally a body, uh-huh. Either feeding the post or being the help defender or something like that. But I was so fortunate to be around great basketball minds. You know, Mark West played 17, 18 years in this league as one of the premier big defenders in the league. John Shumate, great collegiate player, one of the best players in Notre Dame history. He was on that team that snapped the 88-game UCLA win streak. Mm-hmm. And then was a great pro, but had medical issues that kind of cut his career short, but got to play with McAdoo in Buffalo and things like that. And then Igor Kokoshkov, one of the great international coaches, the first international coach to ever be in the NBA. He's been with the Clippers. He won a championship with the Pistons with Larry Brown. Thunder Dan Marley and Alvin Gentry. Mike D'Antoni, of course. The endless list of great, great people I got to be around with. Great insights to the game and great backgrounds. And, you know, my thing as a guy who didn't play in this league was just to be a sponge. Just hang out with those guys and ask questions and learn, and I was really fortunate.
You know, that is really important to say as well, because I was a basketball manager at Wisconsin when Stu Jackson was there and Stan Van Gundy was the assistant.
Okay.
And Sean Miller was the other assistant. And, you know, that was a job where you could just sort of tune out, stand around with a ball and a towel over your shoulder, and just sort of, you know, kind of just 2 hours could go by without you realizing it. But I really, you know, studied Stu and studied Stan, and Stan, you know, would be in the office, and I kind of observe how he ran his stuff there, went through video and stuff. So you could really, really learn a lot just by, if you are, and anyone's listening to this, that's what I can't stress enough, is when there's a perceived job that you might not like, or you might not feel like you're getting the kind of respect because they're not letting you do much.
No.
You can just learn so much. Dude, just being there and listening.
I was so happy just to, I leave out the boring stuff. Like, oh, I had to stock the fridge, and I had to update the standings board, and I had to, we have the deflections board and keep the track of who's leading deflections and charges and things like that. There's all types of menial tasks that you have to do, especially as an entry level person. And even it never goes away. There are assistant coaches, with six-figure salaries that have menial tasks as part of their jobs. It's part of everybody's life. But again, it's what do you do while you're doing that? What can you pick up? And the great thing is, this is the thing that I learned, particularly when dealing with people who had played in the league, is that everybody likes to talk about themselves. And when you're in my position, and you might think, oh man, nobody wants to hear someone ask about, hey, why did you guys do this when you were playing against such and such or whatever? But it's the exact opposite. So, like, even now I'm working for ESPN, and one of the great things that gets to happen is when you go on SportsCenter, before you go on, you go in the green room. And that's literally all the analysts. They're just waiting when it's their turn to go up. So they're all hanging out. Sometimes it's people from other sports. You got Herm Edwards and, the football guys in there. And sometimes it's basketball people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always like, you know, I'm in there with George Karl, and I'm asking him, hey, why did it take you guys so long to switch Gary on to Michael in the finals? Like, I get to ask a question like that. Or Antonio Davis was talking about when they played, Chicago in the conference finals. And they played him close, and then they put Scotty on Mark Jackson. Mm-hmm. And they said, like, the Pacers didn't have an adjustment to go after that. And that was that kind of just – that's why the Bulls won that series. Because mm-hmm. they made the chess move that, they, like, the Pacers had no counter for. But again, these are things that, you know, I'm right now, I'm working for ESPN, I'm on TV. I'm still the same guy where I'm going in there and I see someone. Like, hey, man, what was this like? What did you guys do? You know, or what was some of the things that you guys went through going through that gauntlet? And you just make notes, and those and eventually those stories and those lessons become my lessons. So I'm talking about adjustments or things. I'm bringing up other people's stories. Not because I lived it, but because I know, and I don't have to live it to know it, because, again, you ask enough questions and you understand enough and you study enough film, and it's all becomes a shared experience at some point.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of D'Antoni's offense, like we mentioned before, is what they're doing even in with the Warriors, is that, you know, what he was doing, I had interviewed him, and he told me he's just doing the offense they ran when he was a player in the 70s. And I actually feel like the 70s was the golden age. Right when the NBA and the ABA merged, you had the most elite athletes, but they were still running UCLA high post, triangle, mm-hmm. Princeton. They were running really strict systems almost across the board on every team, but they would be elite athletes doing it, and you get incredible shots. And you know, then they get a little tired, and you get a little bit more ragged player one-on-one. The coach would call timeout. He'd remind them, hey, guys, remember, we run the UCLA high post here, and then they'd go right back into it and passing. And that is really what's exciting to me. When I watch what D'Antoni was doing on that end. But let me just throw this out there, and you could, you know, answer however you like. But, you know, obviously Coach D'Antoni gets a lot of crap about the defensive end, and certainly recently with the Lakers. Can you talk at all about that, and as far as, did the Suns work on defense?
Here's what I've always said about Coach Mike's philosophy. Coach Mike, as you said, is a product of the 70s. And players back then, you know, as we talked about earlier, were smart players. Guys knew how to play. And even as you talk about rigid systems, coaches understood that we're going to draw some lines, but it's up to you to color between those lines. And the improvisation is there. And that's why people always used to compare basketball to jazz, mm-hmm. is that guys are improvising, but at the same time, we're still working harmoniously together. So it doesn't just sound like a bunch of noise. And so as it pertains to defense, Mike was a guy who would talk conceptually about it. And we might do a shell drill or two. But we didn't drill it relentlessly. Like, I've seen other teams where, you know, let's say it's an hour practice or 90-minute practice, 70 of those minutes or 60 of those minutes will be on defense. We didn't do that. And part of it was because, again, Mike's thing was like, we can talk about how we're going to guard the pick and roll. And he expects you as a professional to either understand these concepts or do your due diligence to figure it out, either asking people or watching film or whatever it is. But the other thing was also, we had a very veteran team. Definitely when Coach Mike was here. You talk about Sean Marion, Amar Stoudemire, who was young but had old, you know, he had mileage on his body, obviously. Steve Nash, Roger Bell, and then we added Grant Hill, and then later on we added Shaq. When you got an old team like that, you don't have you've got a little amount of energy these guys have, and are you going to blow it having them go through 4-on-4 shell drill and all this stuff for 60 minutes, or are you going to save it for the actual games when we actually go out there and win? And I think if you look at our defensive efficiency, I know for a fact that 06-07 team, which I still think was the best Suns team, talent-wise, at least, we were above average defensively. It's just at the time, people weren't talking about efficiency. People were talking about points per game. And because we ran such a high pace, it looked like we were just giving up points left and right. But we weren't that bad.
Right.
But as time went on, obviously the slippage began. And so in retrospect, could we have done more? Maybe. But again, I get why he made the decision he did, given our personnel.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I certainly think that, there was 13th that year in defensive rating before anyone talked about defensive rating, which, you know, it's, by the way, like, I love Marv Albert. He deserves as much respect as anybody could ever receive, but he still quotes points per game on defense.
You know what's funny, Coach Nick? Now working on the TV side, mm-hmm. I figured it out. It's all about the producers and the stat people that work with. If they slide him 101 points allowed per 100 possessions, he'll read it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a broadcast, unless you give him some really, okay, if you give him some off-the-wall stat that they don't even understand or ever heard of, then yeah, you might say, get out of here, kid.
Mm-hmm.
But right. if you give him something that's meaningful and easily understand, because you got to remember, it's not just for them to understand, it's for the viewer. And I think sometimes basketball nerds like us, we get spoiled. We talk amongst ourselves. We don't understand there's a huge audience out there that's still, these are still kind of
mm-hmm.
new concepts.
Well, and by the way, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Because you know, most of my audience or a lot of my audience are people like that who are learning. And it's really great to be able to spread that. I mean, I can tell you right now, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I don't think anybody would have horns and ice in their vocabulary as much as they do without
right.
like I'm like obsessed with basically with it, at least I was with horns for a while, and that's what's really exciting about it. I just feel like at some point, you know, whenever I do a stuff with like synergy stats and we talk about the rating, you know, percentiles. That's when I get concerned about the educational system in America, because I get people don't know what percentile is. Yeah, and it's really it's crazy, because it's not, you know, I mean, I thought we all learned that in high school.
SATs, remember the SAT? You got your score and they told you what percentile you were in.
Yeah, well, they probably don't even do that anymore, right?
Oh, well.
You know, it's three parts now. It's up to 2,400 points. It's insane. So, you know, it's real interesting. But so later on, though, obviously with the Lakers, I mean, obviously it was leaking out that like they weren't doing anything on defense. It clearly looked like it wasn't a team that was in that same veteran. Well, you know, you could argue it was, but they certainly didn't look like they understood defense.
Right.
And you could tell that Coach D'Antoni was really frustrated to have an even answer about it. Which also leads me to my other level is when that offense isn't run well. The biggest issue I thought the Lakers had during that stretch was that they'd end up getting these corner threes with four players flat along the baseline, maybe one guy back. And when that corner three misses, it was like, boom, boom, two passes in a layup.
Right.
And, you know, I think Coach D'Antoni broke the record for, like, angry timeouts, storming onto the court, calling timeout per game, because they couldn't get it. Did you watch that era and get a handle on what was going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I did watch it. And you're right. You know, like, the thing – again, this offense is built on spacing. It's built on floor balance. It's built on specific things to do when things happen. And again, you know, and the person who had the most responsibility, I would say, is the guy, the ball handler, whether it was Kobe or you know, Steve was obviously hurt a lot. But so when you go into pick and roll, you want to keep weak side corner field definitely, because you're basically, though, everything about the offense was, I'll give you an example. When we used to play the Celtics, and when the Celtics were really good, we loved it. We loved those teams that wanted to hedge hard and low from the weak side and all that Thibodeau stuff. We loved it because that's what we wanted you to do. We wanted you to have to chase Steve over the top of the pick, and then have to make a tough decision. Am I going to stop Steve? Am I going to stop Amaya rolling? Am I going to stop them both and leave someone in the corner wide open?
Mm-hmm.
That's the offense. Now, the offense bogs down when the ball sticks. So if it goes to the corner, it's shoot it or move it. That's the word. Shoot it or move it. If the ball sticks, that's an issue. If guys don't move, if you just stay stationary, because as the ball comes towards you, you got to maintain spacing. And that either means cut baseline or cut back up around the arc to DHO or fake DHO or whatever. And it sticks when the guy setting the screen is not enthusiastic about setting screens. And what I mean about that is, yes, sometimes you'll pop. Yes, sometimes you'll slip the screen. But at some level, you got to lay wood and roll hard. That's why when you pop, you're open. That's why you can slip and find yourself wide open, is because the defense is expecting you to set a screen and roll hard. And if you don't set a screen, or if you try to slip every time, or if you pop every time, or if you don't roll hard, you meander your way to the rim. Mm-hmm. That bogs down everything because it makes it just so much easier. You know, people always talk about, oh, it's an up-tempo offense, like we're running fast breaking every time. We really weren't. It was about just being fast in the half court. Mm-hmm. You know, playing with tempo, playing with pace in the half court set. And again, when you don't do that, and so a guy like Dwight Howard, who should be a phenomenal role player and was a phenomenal role player in Orlando and has been in Houston, in L.A., because he didn't get post-up touches, he kind of sulked, and so he's not going to roll. Or he's going to sit to his screen and just kind of, like I said, just meander or go to the block as opposed to roll to the front of the rim. And then you got Kobe, who's frustrated, so he's going to just break off and do his own thing. And then you got guys like, guys in the wing like Artest or whoever, you know, Artest obviously early, but later on, you know, guys are just not completely interested or maybe aware of where they are on the court. And when you get those breakdowns offensively, as you noted, it bleeds into defense and transition, and defense and transition bleeds into half-court defense because guys are down, that they've given up easy buckets, and then it all kind of falls apart.
Yeah, I mean, and it's an interesting point that your defense tends to be better when your offense is, because the more you score, the more you're sort of back in position to defend more often. And so part of me always felt like the Thunder's defense kind of benefited a bit from that. Now, they're good, but they also benefited from the notion of the other team was just dribbling the ball, you know, inbounding from the full court quite often. And that was the same for what you guys did with the Suns back in the 7 seconds or less, for sure.
Well, we took it out the basket, though. We ran after makes, and we were the only team in the league. Now, I think you see a lot more teams doing it. We were the only team in the league at the time that would run after a make.
So would you practice that, by the way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of our tenets was, first of all, don't foul. Again, this is in an era where people were like, oh, no easy layups, that kind of Riley 90s stuff. Mm-hmm. And now I think people realize free throw per field goal attempt is a pretty important stat. You look at the Spurs, part of what makes them great is they defend without fouling. Mm-hmm. And for us, our thing was like, don't foul. Play solid defense. If you get beat, you get beat. Let's take it out the basket. They got two. We'll get three on the other end. And so we had all types of – Coach Gentry called it the Clipper drill. And it's literally just 2 minutes of – we're three balls. Was it three balls? Yeah, three balls. 2 minutes and, three guys at a time. Take the ball off the rim. A guy come up in the middle, pushes. One guy fills – lane, one guy goes to the corner or to the three-point line. The ball handler hits one of them. That guy scores. Then someone else passes the ball from out of bounds, and the ball handler shoots. And then the third guy goes and gets it out of the basket. So it's two balls, excuse me. And we do this for 2 minutes nonstop, sprinting. And we got to hit, you know, we'd always have a benchmark. Mm-hmm. And that conditions everyone that when we get the ball, let's get out and get an easy basket. Now, if we don't, you know, in the game, if you don't get it, you don't get it. You can pull it back and then we'll run something. But, you know, again, Coach D'Antoni was kind of the originator and Alvin took on and built on it. It's this idea that it's nuts that anyone would choose to want to play offense against a set defense. Mm-hmm. Like, let's get it when they're discombobulated, when two of their guys haven't crossed half court, when guys still don't know who am I picking up, when there's no help defense. Let's get a shot then. And that's the best shot, really.
Yeah. We just broke down for this morning, I'm going to release it, Brandon Jennings his crazy night last night. And one of the things we noted was that the pace for the Pistons has really improved. And what you see when Brandon Jennings pushes the ball up and is a willing passer, which I'm just staring at it going, how did that happen? You get games where you're going to get 21 assists because of defense, certainly against like a team like the Magic. Yeah, they're not back in time, and they're not going to be able – there's no rotation when you push the ball like that. And it is a little bit strange that you know, some teams consciously don't do that. You know, which also leads me to believe, we talked a little bit about personnel and what you have. Is there any kind of notion that you can improve as a player, and in during the season, or does it, or only in the off season, or does it really doesn't? It's such a small increments of improvement that no one even really factors that in when they're planning their team.
I think it's that. I think there are improvements that happen during the year, but it's often negligible to the naked eye and even to the stats. It's just things like guys being more comfortable. I'll give you an example. We had Jared Dudley, brought him in from Charlotte in the Boris Diaw trade. And when he first came to us, he was playing like mainly four, small ball four for Charlotte. And really was a 20-foot jump shooter. Like, didn't have a three-point range. And that first year, he was talking about, I'm going to get on the scouting report by the end of the year for corner threes. And he kept working on corner threes. And obviously, playing for us, you get a lot of corner threes playing with Steve. And he got to be a pretty good corner three-point shooter by the end of that year. So he went away in the summer and he said, next year I'm going to show them that I can hit them from anywhere. And he worked on above-the-break threes for the whole summer. He came back. He's a 40% shooter with a lot of his shots coming above the break. The next year after that, he said, well, they know I'm a three-point shooter. So I'm going to have to show them that I can put the ball on the floor if they close out too hard. And so he started working on his pull-up game, like his off of hard closeouts, one dribble, two dribble pull-ups. And he came back and he shot, I think, a career high from 16 to 23 feet. Mm-hmm. And then the next year after that was, I think this is now it's towards the end, so he's trying to figure out how he can grow as an offensive player. And Jason Richardson was his bet when he came in as a rookie in Charlotte, and then he got traded, obviously, with them. So he really studied a lot of Jason Richardson coming off screens, pin downs, floppy. So that was his, like, the last stage of his development. He came back after summer working on that, and he really became, his last year in Phoenix, he was really a remarkable player moving off screens. Maybe not Kyle Korver, but compared to where he started coming to us as a second-year player to where he ended up, it was really an incredible growth. And last year with the Clippers, you kind of didn't see it as much, but now you're seeing it a lot with Milwaukee. But I guess the moral of the story is individual skill developments usually happen during the offseason when you can make big jumps. But during the year, you can improve based on the kind of shots that you're getting in the offense and you practicing those shots.
Well, let's talk a little bit about improvement with a specific player that is near and dear to my heart, Russell Westbrook. Because, you know, I'm sure maybe you've seen on Twitter that, you know, people think I'm obsessed with it and I spend way too much time on him. But he's on national TV a lot and it's always sort of in the conversation where, you know, I live in Hollywood. And so we talk about, you know, character arc and how, you know, in the beginning of a movie, a guy is a certain way, and then we follow his character as he changes and evolves. And it's satisfying to us because we see that. And I think my biggest issue with Russell Westbrook, because I'm not going to deny that he can make plays that nobody else in the league can make. But my other argument is those plays are still only worth 2 points. And the decisions that he does that are poor decisions, you know, take away those 2 points or balance those 2 points out. And I don't know if I've seen the kind of, you know, improvement, not necessarily from a skill standpoint, because the skills are there, but decision-making and point guard refinement. What's your take on his game?
Well, I'm a huge Russell Westbrook fan, but I do it within the context of, I always believe that it's about fit. And I think what people see a lot of times or complain about is, I don't think he's a good fit with Kevin Durant. I think they're just really, really, really good. And you put them together, and with almost no structure, they'll win 60 games. That's just a testament to how good those guys are. Mm-hmm. But I think Westbrook would be better served if, and I'm not saying that Oklahoma City should do this, let me just be perfectly clear. I'm just saying if talking about what Russell Westbrook as an individual. If I'm what Russell Westbrook's best friend, and I'm saying, and he asked me, I mean, how can I be better appreciated for what I do? I'd say you got to be on your own team. You got to be on a team where it's built around your talents and your abilities. And I think his decision making will appear to be better based on the options that he has, because he's just, I can't imagine what it's like to be Russell Westbrook. Because literally everything must look like, oh, I got a wide open shot, a wide open layup on this one, or a wide open 14-foot pull up. So it's hard to argue with him and say, oh, there was something better, when in his mind he sees something that's really pretty good, and it's probably rightfully so. But I think playing alongside Durant is part of it. And the other part of it is that I do think that playbook, I think they could be doing so much more offensively with misdirection and keeping them on the weak side and things like that.
I think what you're saying is he'd be better as a two guard.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess because I went for a long time, Coach, when I literally bashed every point guard because they weren't Steve. Because I'd seen Steve, I said, to me, this is what a point guard does. Mm-hmm. And so all these other guys, I would knock, well, I don't know. And then after a while, I talked about this with other people who were around in Phoenix, and after a while, you got to sit back and like, yo, man, there's a reason why this dude's a Hall of Famer, a two-time MVP. Like, those guys don't come around but so often. So you have to really start to, especially in today's day and age, when you look at the golden age of scoring point guards, you have to take a step back and just kind of accept, like, all right, that guy's not walking through the door, so what do I have here? And what I have in Westbrook is I have a guy with great size, great explosion, can finish with either hand at the rim, go end-to-end in a blink of an eye, and can make some pretty incredible plays. And if you run a system where you make the passing decisions for him a little easier and a little bit more, I don't want to say obvious, but basically built around what he's going to do, it makes him a better decision maker within what you're asking him to do. Because he'll never be Steve Nash, he'll never be Chris Paul. But I could argue the opposite, they'll never be him either.
Right. Well, you know, the funny thing is when you say he can finish with either hand at the rim, you know, he's not really a great finisher at the basket.
He is. You know what the problem is?
What?
Is that he takes a bunch of bad shots that brings his field goal percentage down. Like, there's a bunch of, like, you watch Russell, it's not like, oh, like, when I hear bad finisher, I think of guys who, like, Damian Lillard early was a bad finisher.
Yeah.
He's gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
He's gotten a lot better. Steph Curry was a bad finisher early. And to their credit, they realized it and they worked on it and they figured out ways to become more effective around the rim. Westbrook is not a bad finisher. Westbrook is a guy who has bad shot selection.
Right.
And so he'll take shots that I don't care how good of a finisher you are. That's just not a good shot. It's like Kobe Bryant. Like, I would not call Kobe Bryant a bad shooter, right?
Right.
He's a great shooter, but the problem is his palette for a field goal attempt is very different from, let's say, Kyle Korver, who is also a great shooter.
Right.
Kyle Korver running situations like, that's not a shot for me. I'm just going to pass it. And Kobe Bryant is, oh, no, I can make this one. Right. And again, that comes from the, I always say this, Coach Nick, if you or I were 6'6", 220 pounds, with a 38-inch vertical and incredibly skilled, I don't know if we would be NBA. I know, at least in my case, I don't think I'd be an NBA player. Because part and parcel of that is this ridiculous confidence that a normal human being shouldn't have. Like, most of us are humble enough in life, whether you realize it or not, mm-hmm. to recognize, okay, man, I'm not going to take that shot. That's just crazy. My teammates are going to think like, I'm a jerk who doesn't know how to play, da 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 da. And most NBA players, particularly guys that elite echelon, they don't have that. They don't have that humility. And I'm not saying this is a knock. I admire this about them. It's really a hubris that allows you to do the unthinkable. Why? Because you never thought it was unthinkable. And so when I see Steve Nash in the fourth quarter of a playoff game against the Spurs throw behind the back pass between someone's legs, I marvel at his technical ability to do that, but more than that, I marvel at the balls to just do it. Where normal, if I were Steve Nash and I had his skills, his abilities, his athleticism, I wouldn't have done that because I would go, oh my God, I can't, what if I turn it over? What if we, you know, this is a big moment. I'll just do a safe pass.
Yeah.
And in the genius's mind, they're all safe passes, right? Or they're all safe shots. They're all good shots. And I admire that to some extent, but obviously it pays its toll, whether it's turnovers per game, whether it's a bad field goal percentage, what have you.
Right. What I see about Russell Westbrook when he goes to the basket a lot, when he misses those shots, it's not even that it's the worst shot selection. He's just barreling the basket way out of control. And it reminds me of players like our freshmen in high school who are like really great athletes and they haven't learned how to play on balance yet.
They run through the basket.
Yeah.
Not the term, you run through the basket.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly. It's just like they're just too fast. And now we saw Tony Parker come in the league and we saw Greg Popovich just, you know, whatever you want to call it, coach him up in a real robust way. And he learned what a good shot was and what a bad shot was and how to play on balance.
Flip side of that. Pop had to learn that Tony wasn't Avery Johnson, and what, because you hear all the stories, Pop was ready to quit on Tony a million times early. And it took all those other guys to tell Pop, you got to stick with this kid. You got to stick with him. You got to understand what he's about, and you got to stick with him because he's going to help us win
championships. Well, but Pop never stopped trying. I know he wanted to cut him or whatever he wanted to do or give up on it, but at the very least, there was coaching going on.
Yes.
And, I get it. You know, Scott Brooks came into a situation where, you know, nobody wants to be in a situation where they could get fired because a player doesn't want them around. I get it. The NBA is a whole different ballgame for a lot of reasons. But for other reasons, there's still coaching that needs to be done. And yes, it just frustrates me to no end. And, you know, I'm always going to be frustrated with ISO basketball, even if it's, you know, top five offense. So, you know, you call me a hater, but I'm always going to be frustrated with that. But then I'm just frustrated there isn't a character arc for him. He doesn't seem to have sort of learned, you know, his passing isn't always very accurate or on time, you know, either. And certainly any game, I have to say, any game where Russell Westbrook takes, you know, 5, 6, 7 shots more than Kevin Durant is just, you know, a problematic thing for me. If it's a close game where they're, you know, battling, if it's a blowout, whatever.
I always go back to it, what kind of, when people say that, oh, he took, you know, 20 and Durant only got 17 or what, I'm always thinking it's not that, it shouldn't be the number. It should just be what kind of shots were they. Okay. That's what I care about. I was watching the Blazers last night, and one of the guys covering the Blazers sitting next to me, and he said, this team lives by the three and dies by the three, and they got to get out of that. And, you know, as the Blazers are trying to make their comeback, they are gunning a bunch of threes, and he's pointing, like, see, they did it again. I said, yeah, but what made that Wes Matthews shot a bad shot wasn't that it was a three. It was that he caught it, the guy closed out, he took two dribbles to the left, and took a step back fall away three.
Yeah.
Like, that's a bad shot. It's not that he took too many threes, or it's that he took a bad shot. And I'd say the same thing about Russell Westbrook. It's not that he takes more shots than Durant some nights or most nights or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's that how many of those shots are, okay, that wasn't a good one, Russ. That was, we can get something better than that, you know. And part of that comes from when I get the ball, do I feel an intense urge to do something with it every single time, or am I comfortable getting the ball and just swinging it? And that's what I think what you're talking about is coaching them up in the sense that how can I be an effective player without dominating the ball?
Okay, I can give that to you, and I just feel like that's where the coaches, you know, are supposed to be able to help and shape.
Yes.
And understand, and that's why I feel like that's going to hold them back. Aside from the from the James Harden thing and losing him, which was ultimately a mistake, primarily because James Harden would be on the ball and it would kind of push Russ over to the wing. And I also feel like people don't necessarily understand, attacking from the top and attacking from the wing or the corner are entirely different things. And Russ, I would think, would be the first or second best shooting guard in the league if they would get him off the ball, if he would stop taking so many just no passing. By the way, if he doesn't pass the ball and shoots the 15-foot pull-up, he could do that all game. And also, if I had an offense that would get 50 threes that were all, like, you know, good threes that were open, then, hey, have at it, right? Like, those are all, you're right, like you said, good shots. But, you know, there just sometimes there just needs to be more of an authority, and I just don't know if that's ever going to exist on the Thunder. And then, you know, I guess I don't know what's going to happen if they end up winning a title after I've been pointing out saying that this doesn't seem possible with the setup as it is now. What do you think I should do? Do I have to do a breakdown naked or run? I have to probably do something really crazy.
Yeah, no. My drum I've been beating for the Thunder for the last couple of seasons is you don't need to fire Scott Brooks. I think he deserves credit for the development of a lot of players not named Westbrook, Durant, or Harden. Look at Reggie Jackson. You look at Thabo Sefolosha. You look at Steven Adams now. They do a great job of taking players and getting them better. So he deserves credit for that. But he does need some help.
All right.
He's an offensive coordinator. That's what I would say.
Interesting. Well, oh no, I don't know. I'm not even sure I would. Okay.
You know, no? Well, you're not.
Well,
talk to me here.
Well, they don't run offense. What offense would they coordinate?
That's why they need an offensive coordinator.
Oh, they need one. I thought you said he is the offensive coordinator.
No. They need one.
They need
someone to come in. That's what I'm saying. They don't need to fire him. They need someone to come in and say, look, this is what we're going to run. We're going to do this, and then. Let Scott be the leader, the CEO, you know, the big decision maker. But in terms of the nitty-gritty X's and O's, and the creativity to think of things to run, the suggestions of what plays to draw, you know, when the coaches huddle before they talk to the players in timeouts, coach, I really think we should run, you know, elbow Boston or whatever. And then he goes back and then he'll drop the play. Let him do that. But he needs help.
I think. Yeah, although I also would argue that just bringing in a pass-first, defensive-minded point guard to play alongside Russ, Reggie Jackson didn't end up sort of being that guy, and he's in a contract year. It sounds like he's sort of trying to, you know, play for that contract, unfortunately. But I've always felt like they play better, even when they had Rafer Alston, right, a few years ago. There was that notion when in the playoffs where they had moments where they played better when Russ could just be off the ball and attack. You want me to ask you about or mention, I did a Vine last night on Twitter where Russ was complaining to a ref and he's, you know, dropped the mother effer at him and the ref just nods and you wanted me to ask you about that. What was on your mind?
No, this is a funny story because we were playing the Pistons it's a long time ago now. And Rasheed Wallace is known for his colorful language on the court. And this night was like no other, you know, like any other. He's just cussing away every single thing. Anytime any call went against him, he let the ref have it. And so there's a play late in the game, and we run screen and roll and hit Amari on the roll. And as he goes up, he gets hit hard, misses the shot, no call. And Stat claps his hand hard and says, bleep, you know, the F word. Technical foul. And everyone's like, rap, what do you do? You know, I was like, using, this is when they first started, like, we're not going to take the abusive language anymore, kick, you know, right? So coach is talking to me, what was that? And he said, you know, he said, ah, and I said, coach said, Rasheed's been saying that all day, every third word out of Sheed's mouth is F, MF, this, da-da-da, calling you guys all types of things. And the response was, yeah, but that's just how he talks. So, and as soon as you showed that line and see Russ just talking and the ref kind of nodding, it's funny how like some guys literally just ascend to a different echelon. Like, yo, this is just, that's how he talks. This is, he doesn't know how to express himself any other way. So we're just going to accept it. As opposed to someone who doesn't say anything all game long and then says it. It's like, well, now I know you meant it, you know, so.
Wow.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, great stuff. Let's do this like, I don't know, five more times. And by the way, you are welcome. Anytime to come back, I have a whole list of things we can talk about. And thanks for being so gracious to spend some time with us. And look forward to the next one.
All right. Thanks a lot, Coach. And thanks for having me.
You got it. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel. We're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Amin?
I'm in, Coach.